Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. President Barack Obama praised a historic 24-hour period in U.S.-Iran relations Sunday, commending strong American diplomacy after implementation of a landmark nuclear deal and a prisoner swap that led to the release of five Americans held by Iran. Both countries announced a prisoner swap Saturday, leading to the release of the Americans in exchange for clemency for seven Iranians charged or convicted for violating U.S. trade sanctions against Iran. Shortly after, Washington confirmed billions of dollars in international sanctions on Iran would be lifted after it met its obligations under July 2015 nuclear accord. Mr. Obama also acknowledged the U.S. Treasury Department announced Sunday to impose new sanctions on five individuals and several companies for ties to Tehran's ballistic missile program. President Obama said the nuclear deal was never intended to resolve all of our differences with Iran.
We still have sanctions on Iran for its violations of human rights, for its support of terrorism, and for its ballistic missile program, and we will continue to enforce these sanctions vigorously.
In a speech earlier Sunday, the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, said the Islamic Republic has entered a new chapter in its history while praising the end of international sanctions. A plane carrying several Americans freed by Iran, as we spoke of earlier, as part of that prisoner swap, has taken off from Tehran. Among those en route to Switzerland are Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian, former U.S. Marine Amir Mirzai Hekmati, and Christian pastor Saeed Abdani. The men will then head to a U.S. military hospital in Germany for medical treatment. The release of the four Americans was announced Saturday, hours before Iranian and Western diplomats made the announcement. VOA News. The Somali Islamist extremist group Al-Shabaab says it captured some Kenyan soldiers during last week's attack on an African Union peacekeeping base in southwestern Somalia. Somali troops and Kenyan soldiers with the AU force AMISOM are deployed at the isolated base. Also Sunday, four wounded Kenyan soldiers were airlifted home, but Kenyan officials gave no death toll. The Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, confirmed Friday that some soldiers had been killed in that attack, which involved suicide car bombs and gunmen. Officials in eastern Afghanistan say a suicide bomber has killed at least 13 people and wounded 14. A spokesman for the Nangarhar provincial government said the bomber detonated his device Sunday morning in Jalalabad at the residential compound of Ibadullah Shinwari. He's a prominent member of Nangarhar's provincial council. Shinwari escaped unharmed. Israel's prime minister has condemned the lifting of crippling international sanctions on Iran following the UN Nuclear Agency's certification that Tehran is curbing its nuclear program. Robert Berger reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that despite the agreement with the world powers, Iran has not given up its quest for nuclear weapons. Netanyahu told his cabinet, lifting sanctions will provide Iran with more resources to undermine stability in the Middle East and spread terrorism around the world. He called on the international community to closely monitor Iran's nuclear facilities and reimpose sanctions if there are any violations. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
A monitoring group says at least 400 civilians have been kidnapped by Islamic State militants during an attack Saturday in the Syrian city of Deir al-Zor. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says women, children, and family members of pro-government and fighters were among those captured after IS forces seized a suburb. A man was left brain dead after taking part in a drug trial for an experimental painkiller based on a compound similar to cannabis died in France Sunday. According to Rennes University Hospital in a statement, French health authorities have said three of those still hospitalized face possible brain damage, and an investigation is underway into what the French health minister called an accident of exceptional gravity. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Oh, Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
For the first time in the history of our elections in Uganda, we are going to use a biometric voter verification equipment at every polling station.
The Ugandan Electoral Commission plans to use a biometric system to identify voters during the upcoming general election.
The country's a Western ally in the fight against terrorism. It has a lot of soldiers in the UN operation in Mali.
Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb claims responsibility for the terrorist attacks in the Burkina Faso capital, Ouagadougou.
We do support decentralization indeed, and we also provide subsidies to local authorities for water and sanitation, rural electrification.
And mayors of major cities in Central Africa agreed to diversify their revenue sources in a bid to improve the livelihoods of their populations. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Ugandan Electoral Commission plans to meet this week with representatives of the country's 8 presidential candidates, political parties and stakeholders to explain its decision to use a biometric system to verify voters in the February 18 general election. This will be the first time that the electoral body employs a biometric system which uses human body characteristics to confirm a person's identity. Jotham Taremwa, a spokesman for the Electoral Commission, told me the deployment of the biometric verification mechanism at all polling stations will significantly boost the credibility of the presidential, legislative and local elections.
Well, for the first time in the history of our elections in Uganda, we are going to use a biometric voter verification equipment at every polling station. When you come as a voter, the machine identifies you as so and your voting status by using either your thumbprint or a barcode on your national ID or a barcode on the voter location slips that will be issuing at least 2 weeks before the polling. But to take you back, you remember we did biometric voter registration of Ugandans. So it would be a loss for us to register Ugandans biometrically, and then we don't use a biometric system to identify them at their respective polling stations. Well, so far, we have received about 17,000 out of over 30,000 machines we require.
Will there be a backup in case some of these machines fail? Because in other parts of Africa where these machines were used, there were systemic failures. So will there be a backup if the system goes down?
We have about 1,400 sub-counties in Uganda. And each sub-county will have at least 2 machines that we will use in case there is a technical problem on one of the machines within that sub-county.
What necessitated the decision of the Electoral Commission to use the biometric system for the first time in the country's history of organizing elections?
It is part of our operational reforms as Electoral Commission to ensure that the principle of one man, one vote holds. And that's why we needed that machine to identify for us a voter, and then we can check that voter in the register, but also ensure that we know somebody's voting status. Previously, when we didn't have biometric voter registration, somebody would vote in a distance of, say, 20 kilometers and drive his vehicle and vote in another distance of 30 kilometers. So there were chances that the process could be rigged. But this time, we think we are choosing that one.
Has the Electoral Commission begun education nationwide to bring up to speed the prospective voters so they are not confused about this new process?
That is a very good question. First of all, we want to ensure that our stakeholders gain appreciation of why we need to use this machine. We are beginning with a training of our Electoral Commission staff, but next week, on the 19th, we are going to engage with all the parties and the official agents of the candidates to talk about this machine, but also demonstrate to them on how it will be used and what advantages come with it. And later, we will roll out to our districts, sub-counties, and parishes, so that by the time we go for polling, everybody appreciates and knows how the machine works.
What is the progress of the printing of the ballot papers, and in which countries are these being printed in order to safeguard what you call the integrity of the voting process, ensuring the ballot papers are not tampered with in any way?
Printing of ballot papers taking place in four countries. One is Uganda. There's already printing going on. Another one is South Africa. The other one is United Arab Emirates. And the other one is the United Kingdom. The printing started, this is like a second week, and we are in advanced stages of completing the printing of ballots from those outside countries. I will be briefing you from time to time as and when we start getting the batches.
Jotam Taremwa is the spokesman for the Ugandan Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Armed men stormed a restaurant and a hotel in Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou, on Friday, killing at least 29 people of 18 nationalities. The attack has been claimed by Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. For VOA, Emily Ilb has more from the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan.
The usually busy street in front of the splendid hotel in Ouagadougou is empty of civilians this Saturday afternoon, just hours after the attacks. The area has been sealed off by police, and as of mid-afternoon, emergency personnel were still pulling out the bodies of victims out of the hotel and the restaurant that were targeted by armed men. Dozens of onlookers watched the scene from afar, many of whom said they needed to come to understand what had actually happened. Saluka Yasia is still in shock. He was a waiter at the restaurant that was targeted and managed to hide from the attackers. I thought a lot about my family, he said. My little sons are only 2 and 9 years old. I thought a lot about them. What would have become of them if I wasn't around anymore? Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM, claimed responsibility for the attacks. The jihadist group was already behind a raid on an upscale hotel in Mali's capital Bamako last November, which left 22 people dead, including the two attackers. For Cynthia Oyon, a researcher at the International Crisis Group, this first attack in Ouagadougou doesn't come as a surprise.
The country has a long, porous border with Mali, where a lot of these groups are present and operate. And, you know, they've been moving from the north of Mali to the center in the south of Mali. And so it's kind of only logical geographically that they eventually are coming down to Burkina Faso.
Earlier on Friday, an attack in a village on the border with Mali left 2 people dead. The Burkinabe government said the 20 armed men behind that attack had fled. It isn't clear whether the attack on the village and the one in Ouagadougou are connected. Oyon says besides its geography, other factors explain why Burkina Faso can be considered a target for terrorist groups in the Sahel region.
The country is a Western ally in the fight against terrorism. It has a lot of soldiers in the UN operation in Mali. These hotels are symbols of, you know, like business going on, tourism, so all of the symbols that the terrorists want to destroy.
Burkina Faso's government said Saturday morning that the assault on the hotel was over, that 4 jihadists had been killed and more than 120 hostages released. Emily Yab for VOA News in Ouagadougou.
Rumors about President Robert Mugabe's state of health and sharp reactions by ZANU-PF and presidential spokesman George Charamba have set the social and mainstream media on fire. Some Zimbabweans are now urging the government to disclose his state of health while on holiday in the Far East following unconfirmed reports that he suffered a heart attack. The government dismissed the report as baseless. For VOA, Ivan Chafera reports from the capital, Harare.
Some local people say while Mr. Mugabe is now 91 years old, an age which is commonly associated with many health challenges, it is unlikely that he is sick, as such reports have been circulating over the years when the president is on vacation in Asia. President Mugabe and his wife left for a vacation on December the 15th at an unspecified destination in the Far East following the ZANU-PF People's Conference held in Victoria Falls. When the president left the country, Vice President Pelekezela Mpoko took over as acting president, a position he held until recently when Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa returned from leave. Mnangagwa is currently the acting president, a move that has generated a lot of interest among Zimbabweans when he took over from Mpoko. This coincided with a report that the president had some health issues. Some observers and government insiders say this arrangement was made before Mr. Mugabe went on leave, though Charamba and ZANU-PF spokesman Simon Kayamoyo have squashed rumors that the president may be experiencing health challenges while on leave after allegedly experiencing a heart attack. This has set social and mainstream media on fire. What would ease the nation's angry curiosity about the state of their president? Melod Garaipa of Chitungwiza said, while she is now familiar with the annual rumor concerning the president's health, there is need for government to open up about his condition and whereabouts.
And it normally happens every January. So I think it's also important for the ZANU-PF people to communicate the correct message to the public regarding the health and the whereabouts of the president so that they can curb the speculations.
Garaipa said the president must at times spend his holidays in the country to avoid such kind of reports. Milton Piri of Harare's Rugari High Density Suburb said, while the president's health problems have, in his words, become a usual January rumor, it clearly shows what Zimbabweans think about Mr. Mugabe's state of health all the time.
I think now the people are now cooking stories, and I think if the day comes, there will be celebration in Zimbabwe, in the streets of Zimbabwe.
But for ZANU-PF youth Onias Mabara of Mbare, the rumors were cooked up by the president's enemies.
These are false and malicious reports intended to damage the image of the president.
Independent political commentator Fortune Gwaze concurred, saying the nation is now accustomed to the rumors.
I don't think there is anything to end unless we see him not coming back when he's supposed to assume his duties in early February or end of January.
For Owen Huayo, the health concerns are the work of some political players who want to portray Mr. Mugabe as an invincible man.
When people start talking about Mugabe's death, then the next day they see him well, coming up strongly, and then they say, this guy is invincible. So they want to paint a picture of Mugabe as someone who's beyond human frailties, like he's not affected by his health.
But Harare Polytechnic media lecturer Wellington Gadzikwa blamed all this on what he called short journalism.
Media organizations or journalists are churning out or writing stories that are false, that really have no facts, that are fictitious, and that are also malicious. People will never trust the media, because why should you trust the same media which gives you false information to give you accurate information? So the media profession is likely not to be taken seriously.
Rumors of this nature have occurred annually, with a memorable headline once quoting President Mugabe stating that, quote, "I'm not dead." Mr. Mugabe, who has ruled Zimbabwe for more than 35 years, turns 92 next month. Meanwhile, Mnangagwa and Mpoko have taken turns to serve in Mr. Mugabe's position while he's on leave. Political analysts say there was nothing wrong with the arrangement, given that they've always done so in the past. UI said it did not matter who acted as president, because patent government meetings such as the ruling ZANU-PF Politburo and cabinet do not take place when Mr. Mugabe is on leave or out of the country.
It proves that Zimbabwean politics is shaped around an individual and not an institution. This poses a lot of problems when you come to decision making.
Former Zimbabwe National Students Union leader Tafadzwa Mugwadi said it was important for the two vice presidents to alternate, as it gave them experience to lead the nation.
It's giving both of them, an opportunity to, showcase their potential, demonstrate their ability to run the nation and assist the president, especially when he's not available.
Mr. Mugabe, who is also chairman of the African Union, is expected back home at the end of this month. This is Ivan Chifera.
Mayors of major cities in Central Africa have agreed to diversify their revenue sources, promote decentralization, and improve governance to better the livelihoods of their growing populations. The mayors from Chad, Cameroon, Central African Republic, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, and Congo-Brazzaville met Saturday in the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé, to find solutions to problems they encounter as huge numbers of poor people rush to cities in search of better living conditions. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
27-year-old Changa Etoga Emil Wells' pieces of rejected household metal to produce window protectors in Itubi, a neighborhood in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. He says the work enables him to take care of himself, his wife, three children, and old parents.
Quand j'obtiens mon CP, les parents n'ayant plus les moyens pour m'envoyer à l'école.
He says he and his two elder brothers left the village of Ntui in Cameroon's center region because their parents were not able to send them to school. He says living in Yaoundé is easier because he can pay his water and electricity bills, rent a house, and save some money. Emil is just one of the thousands of youths who leave the hinterlands of Cameroon every year for better lives in the cities. Cameroon's National Institute of Statistics indicates Yaoundé now has a population of more than 2 million people, up from barely 1 million 10 years ago. Celestine Ketcha-Cortez, mayor of the Cameroonian town of Bangante, says such movement towards cities is exerting pressure on social infrastructure and natural resources. She says it has failed to bring inclusive growth and has resulted in a proliferation of slums, urban poverty, and rising inequality. And she says there has not been any corresponding increases in social housing programs, markets, road infrastructure, schools, hospitals, and leisure establishments. Cortez says local councils are supposed to take care of the immediate needs of their growing populations while waiting for central government support. But she says local officials lack financial resources.
I'm not sure that 80% of our population are paying their taxes. Is paying what will support the local authority to fill their mission by delivering the essential services. That means water and sanitation. That means education. So paying taxes is bringing the citizen to be in participation of local development.
The United Nations Development Programme reports that urban population growth has been very rapid in Central African states. According to the most recent data compiled for the region, the population increased 48% in 2013, with 85% in Gabon, 24% in Chad, 54% in Cameroon, 40% in the Central African Republic, 39% in Equatorial Guinea, and 65% in Congo-Brazzaville. Francois Collet, head of the European Union delegation to Cameroon, says her institution has urged central governments to transfer power and resources to local councils to enable them to meet the needs of their growing populations.
We do support decentralization indeed, and we also provide subsidies to local authorities for water and sanitation, rural electrification. You understand that for contributing to a budget of a local authority, we need transparency and security of our funding. We think it contributes to the real improvement of the lives of people.
At the conclusion of their meeting Saturday, the mayors called for strong political commitments from their governments. They also decried the political instability in the Central African Republic and terrorism in Cameroon that has continued to push youths to cities where they seek safety. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The West African nation of Sierra Leone is restarting the 42-day countdown to being declared free of transmission of the Ebola virus after a woman died of the deadly virus on Tuesday. It is a setback for the nation after it was declared Ebola-free for 2 months. For VOA, Nina DeVries reports from the capital, Freetown. Health officials are now on the alert for more cases, just as the deadliest outbreak on record appeared to be ending.
A 22-year-old woman who died of Ebola is the country's newest case. Sidi Yaha Tunis with the Ministry of Health and Sanitation says she was from the northern part of the country.
They've done preliminary investigation. They've been able to identify about 27 contacts who are now isolated for further monitoring. And more investigation is being carried out, and we continue to bring out information to the public the more we get.
Tunis says two households are currently under quarantine. WHO declared the Ebola outbreak over in West Africa earlier this week after no new cases emerged in Liberia. Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea were the three countries most affected by the worst Ebola outbreak in history, which began 2 years ago. Tunis, head of the External Communications Emergency Operations Center, adds that people may have started to be too relaxed after the country was announced Ebola-free. This latest case may indicate they've gone back to old habits, such as washing and touching a dead body. The virus is transmitted through bodily fluids and is most contagious at death.
It's still very preliminary, but it is highly possible considering the fact that the person died at home and was buried in the community. So it is highly likely that the body was washed.
More than 11,000 people died from this latest Ebola outbreak, almost 4,000 in Sierra Leone. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
The UN Refugee Agency reports growing numbers of Mozambicans fleeing fighting between RENAMO rebels and government forces are seeking asylum in neighboring Malawi. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports an almost unstoppable flow of refugees from Mozambique is crossing over the border into Malawi. The agency says its staff in the village of Kapise, about 100 kilometers south of the capital, Lilongwe, so far has registered nearly 1,300 new arrivals, with more than 900 people waiting to be recorded. It says another 400 people have arrived in 16 other villages. UNHCR spokeswoman Karen De Gruel says most of the refugees are women and children who come from Tete province in Mozambique. She says the refugees report fighting between the opposition, RENAMO, and government forces is making life impossible in their home villages.
Refugee women told you a UNHCR protection officer how their homes were burned down with one elderly lady left inside to die. They say that government forces are attacking villages believed to be harboring opposition forces and opposition members. We have not been able, however, to confirm the accuracy of these allegations. Some parents also stated that they've been separated from their children during flight.
De Gruel says the UNHCR and government authorities in Malawi believe the fighting in Mozambique, which broke out in February last year, would be temporary. Therefore, she says, agreements were made with the national authorities for local communities to host some 700 Mozambican refugees who had arrived in mid-2015.
In the past few weeks, however, the situation has changed and more people are crossing into Malawi, and we have reports that more people are coming. Malaria is a major concern as there are not enough mosquito nets, and the number of patients seen daily has increased from 70 to 250 people.
De Gruel says several UN aid agencies, as well as the charity Doctors Without Borders, are in hand to help the refugees with food, non-food items, and medical relief. She says the government of Malawi is considering reopening Luani refugee camp, which previously hosted refugees from Mozambique's long-running civil war. That war, which was waged between 1977 and 1992, prompted more than 1 million Mozambicans to flee to Malawi. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. One of the big events this year will be the 2016 Rio Olympics. In one of the events, South Africa, Nigeria, and Algeria will represent Africa at the Men's Olympic Football Tournament. Now let's take a look at how the three got there and what their prospects are. VOA's Sunny Young spoke with our African football guru, David Led.
Right, Sunny, we take it up from the semi-final stage. Nigeria upsetting Senegal 1-0, a terrible scoring from a 77-minute penalty. And then Algeria far too good for South Africa, winning 2-0. Darfalou early in the first half, and then Kamasa early in the second half, scoring the goals. Now, those victories, Sunny, assured Nigeria and Algeria of places in the final. And then we had this unusual situation. We had the third-place match followed by the final. And, in fact, it was the third-place match that was of crucial importance. That was South Africa against Senegal, and that would decide the third and final place for the Rio Games. An amazing match. If it was boxing, Sunny, Senegal would have won hands down. They had 25 shots at goal, but significantly only 6 on target. South Africa had 10 shots at goal, 6 on target. But finally, after 74 minutes, it seemed as if the incessant Senegalese pressure was going to pay off when they were awarded a penalty. But a brilliant save from Jody February saved South Africa, and then as the ball ran loose inside the goal mouth, in rushed Keita, and I thought, this is it, Senegal are going to score off the rebound. But the woodwork came to the rescue of the South Africans. And there and then, Sonny, I thought to myself, the South Africans took Lady Luck to dinner the previous evening, and they impressed her, because that was really a double, big, big let-off. I think, Sonny, that raised the spirits immeasurably of the South Africans, and significantly, I think it lowered those of the Senegalese. The match finished 0-0 after 90 minutes, no extra time, which I think the South Africans would have been very appreciative of, because as we've said on all our reports about this tournament in Senegal, it was mid-afternoon and the sun was beating down close to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And that clearly gave the Senegalese an edge, but unlike the first meeting between these two countries, which finished 3-1 for Senegal, South Africans showed a lot more passion, a lot more fight. So we went to a penalty shootout, and Jody February, 19 years of age, he plays for Ajax Cape Town, he became the hero of the afternoon. He saved not one, not two, but 3 of the shootout spot kicks taken by the Senegalese. The South Africans, much more accurate, they scored 3 of their 5, so they won 3-1 on the penalty shootout. Afterwards, the Senegalese coach was crestfallen, understandably. I didn't quite agree with him when he said that his team were the best in the tournament. I think the Nigerians were actually the best. And they proved that in many senses by winning the final against Algeria by 2-1. Fascinating match. You had the flair of the Nigerians against the organization of the Algerians. And if February was the star of the South African victory, then Etebo from Wari Wolves was the toast of Nigeria. He finished, Sunny, as the leading goal scorer with 5, including both in the final. The first he converted a penalty, and then a brilliant solo run from the center circle 5 minutes before halftime, slotted the ball past Sally like a seasoned veteran, and that gave the Nigerian Dream Team 6, as they're known, a 2-1 victory. I am impressed, Sonny, with the flair of the Nigerians, and I think there's room there for improvement, and I think Samson Sia, the coach, will get it. I'm very impressed, too, by the Algerian organization. I think they will also do well at Rio. I think South Africa have a lot of room for improvement. They rolled their luck against Senegal They are fighters every time, as a coach on the Gama pointed out. They played badly. They did bounce back. After losing to Senegal on day one, they did bounce back to beat Zambia and then Tunisia. And after that pretty good hiding from the Algerians, they did come back strongly against the Senegalese in the third place playoff. But certainly, Sonny, you've got to stick a room for improvement tag on that South African team. And just to confirm again, the Olympics will be played in August 2016. And an important change for the finals, whereas the qualifying matches in all the regions of the world are restricted to under 23 footballers, at the finals you're allowed what they call three wild cards. Now those wild cards are players of any age. So in other words, I think we've used this on your show before, Sonny. If it's Argentina, they can use Lionel Messi. If it's Portugal, they can use Cristiano Ronaldo. You are free to use three overage players. And it does trigger an interesting debate, because some coaches will use that rule and will bring in three senior stars. But other coaches are of the view that, hold on a minute, these under 23 players got us to Rio in the first place. I'm going to keep faith with them, and I will stick to the under 23 footballers.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. In terms of the three African teams that qualified for the Rio Games men's football tournament, Nigeria has the proudest Olympic pedigree. The Nigerians won gold at Atlanta 1996 and a silver at Beijing 2008. Algeria and South Africa have each made only one previous Olympic appearance. The Algerians reached the quarterfinals at the 1980 Moscow Olympics, and the South Africans did not get out of the group stage at the 2000 Sydney Olympics.
Thanks, Sunny. The Rio Olympic Games 2016 begin on Friday, August 5th, and end on Sunday, August 21st. Peter?
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline, Africa Sports.
This God is beautiful. She's beautiful.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
ya hene mireta te wali woluna kulene kweka me and you could always be forever.
She's moving like a time bomb, she wanna explode, she a move like a time bomb, ready for explode, she dey move like a time bomb, she wanna explode. Shorty move like a time bomb, ready for explode. Time bomb, time bomb, time bomb,
she wanna explode.
Time bomb, time bomb, time bomb, explosion.
Yo, man to man, don't come around. I want pretty ladies all around me. That sexy girl with a bad physique, I've never seen a girl like you. 10 to 1, that's the countdown. She's about to explode and constant fusion. My girl, she's bad, she's number one. I've never seen a girl like you.
That girl, I tell you she be time bomb. Boom, don't stop, boogie, baby, wine on. Hey, your body, they define her. This guy in boogie, no be minor.
No,
no, this body be designer. Some girl fine, but you fine her.
See?
Continue to wine her. Cause me never seen a girl like you.
Now I let her wine.
Time bomb.
A body fire.
Time bomb.
She my desire.
Time bomb.
She make me lose control.
Explosion.
She sexy, bad sexy Nina.
Time bomb.
She came with a friend called Sabrina.
Time bomb.
Don't stop, sister Nina.
Time bomb.
Baby, go low. I just wanna love you. Share with me your problems. Girl, you are the type of girl a bad man need. I just wanna love you. Share with me your problems. Girl, you are the type of girl a bad man feel. Lean on me. My girl, you are the only one for me. You're the only thing I see. Lean on me. Oh, you are the only one for me. You're the only thing I see. Yeah.
Bumba overload. Type of bumba with black road. Just the sight of bumba make you feel so good. My soul food. Me some of my journey walk out there. Gas, gas, I make serious, I know they joke. You make man confused, I know if you go. The machine about me too, I mean some about you. Hey, no between us.
No.
I go direct, make she see, say I mean I'm some romantic arena. I wanna take her to a place where the past is
between
us. Time bomb.
A body fire.
Time bomb.
She my desire.
Time
she
bomb.
Make me lose control.
Explosion.
Bring sexy back, sexy Nina.
Time bomb.
She came with a friend called Sabrina.
Time bomb.
Don't stop, sister Nina.
Time bomb.
Baby, go low.
Explosion.
Now I wine.
Time bomb.
A body fire.
Time bomb.
She my desire.
Time
she
bomb.
Make me lose control.
Explosion.
Bring sexy back, sexy Nina.
Time bomb.
She came with a friend called Sabrina.
Time bomb.
Don't stop, sister Nina.
Time bomb.
Baby, go low.
Explosion.
I be your number one fan and I dig by do your show. The things where you did display makes me wanna spend my dough. When you take it fast, when you take it slow. Baby, you're the baddest and I hope you know. I know you're upcoming and I know you glow. Can't you see in the dark you glow? Make you no change cause I love you so. Can't nobody do me better, 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 better than you. Can't nobody love me better, 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 better than you. This one no be joke, oh. You didn't make me call, oh, yeah. When the fast or slow mo, shawty, let me see you. Take it down low, rock this body. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Take it down low, rock this body. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Take it down low, rock this body. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Take it down low, rock this body. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Now you, I can't see. I want you to take.
Direction.
your perfection. Now you need to make me crazy, cause I'm loving the things that you wear. Cause you got a good taste. There's nowhere else I'd rather be than at your place, yeah. Can't nobody do me better, 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 better than you. Can't nobody love me better, 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 better than you. This one no be joke, oh. You didn't make me colo. Get the fast or slow-mo. Shawty, let me see you. Take it down low. Rock this party. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Take it down low. Rock this party. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Take it down low. Rock this party. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Take it down low. Rock this party. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Now you, I come and see. I want you to take good care. Make a man hard, but he no be wood. I be hearing stories about how you doing it good. Your sexy moves turn me on, I'm in the mood. I would take you home and make you mine if I could. Let's get faded and lost in the moment. If this you got that for buddy, I swear I wanna own it. You make me wanna spray this cash when you roll it. Pause, now let me remote control it.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Al-Shabaab, the Somali terrorist group affiliated with Al-Qaeda, have struck again. This time, however, it has avoided its usual soft civilian targets and attacked an Amazon military base in the south close to the Kenyan border. There are two versions of what transpired. Al-Qaeda announced that it had attacked a Kenyan military base, killed a minimum of 60 Kenyan soldiers, and taken over the base camp. The Kenyan military version is different. It stated that Al-Qaeda attacked a Somali military camp near a Kenyan camp and that the Kenyans had intervened to support the Somalis, and in the process lost about 40 Kenyan soldiers. Some of these soldiers were paraded in the town. The peacekeeping force, AMISOM, supported by the United Nations, has not yet given its own assessment of the situation. But this event marks another example of the inability to learn the lesson of terrorism. Terrorism, whether regional or international, is a global affair, and it is essential that one looks for a global solution. Just imagine what happened last Friday evening after the attack in Somalia, when terrorist group in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, entered an hotel, took hostages, and in a rescue operation at the end, 13 casualties were announced. Or even go back to December in Bamako, Mali, when a similar terrorist action occurred. Not to mention the daily terrorist casualties in Nigeria and neighboring countries. No one can doubt the efforts of the governments in this area to deal with Boko Haram. But it is not an easy matter to detect at all occasions a child with a suicide vest walking into a marketplace or in a bus stop and detonating their vest. It's very difficult. What you have is that when you have terrorist acts, politicians tend to minimize the difficulties and make an assumption that it is possible to deal with these terrorist acts. Yes, intelligence can try its best, military forces can do it, but you cannot, under present circumstances, detect all terrorist acts. For example, the attack in Somalia is very similar to an attack perpetrated by the Taliban terrorist group in Afghanistan just a few weeks ago, when trucks were packed full of explosives and then they were blown up when they tried to breach the base camp. So this is something which the world community should bring pay attention to. The Secretary General of the United Nations just a few weeks ago made a pertinent statement that it is necessary to look at the underlying causes for terrorist activities. This is very similar to a resolution by the General Assembly at the time of the Munich Olympic crisis when Israeli athletes were murdered. This is why it is difficult to understand why in Somalia not much effort is being made to see whether there can be an accommodation with Al-Shabaab. It will not be easy, but the effort should be made. Why are not efforts being made to reach a better political solution in Somalia? It is not enough that Al-Shabaab has been moved out of all major cities and towns. Still, they're able to punish and perpetrate terrorist acts in Somalia. In Syria, where we have also daily terrorist acts, efforts are being made to bring all the parties together to minimize terrorist acts and to confront the terrorist group of the Islamic State. So this is something which the United Nations, the African Union, should do in Somalia. Even in Nigeria, President Buhari had said that he is prepared to meet competent and serious partners in Boko Haram to find a political accommodation. Terrorism cannot be fought only by military means. There is a need to also search for political solution to deal with this global menace. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Kali Nashwan, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the earth is a beehive. We all enter by the same door, but live in different cells. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is welcome news that Iranian officials have released Christian pastor Farshid Fathi. A convert to Christianity, Mr. Fathi had served 5 years in prison on charges related to his faith. He was reportedly the last member released of a cohort of some 60 Christians who were arrested by agents of Iran's intelligence ministry on December 26, 2010. Unfortunately, Pastor Fathi's release does not appear to be a sign of a let-up of the persecution of Christians in Iran. Human rights monitors report that in late December, Iranian officials in Isfahan entered the home of Christian convert Mehsam Hojati, confiscating his personal belongings, including his computer and Bible, and moved him to an unknown location where he is still in detention. There are also reports that in Shiraz, 9 Christians were arrested while attending church on December 25th. Mansour Borji, a spokesman for the Alliance of Iranian Churches, known as Hamgam, told the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran that it has become common for security agents to arrest Christian converts in various cities when many communities celebrate Christmas. By making these arrests around this time, he said, the government hopes to intimidate converts by threatening them with heavy punishments so that they would either leave the country or stop their religious activities. The latest human rights report on the plight of religious minorities in Iran by the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Iran notes that close to 50 Christians remain in prison solely because of their religious beliefs. The report makes clear that other religious minorities are also targeted by the government, most particularly the Baha'is, as well as Sunnis and Shia, who challenge the regime's theological orthodoxy, Jews, Yarsanis, and Zoroastrians. When he was running for president in 2013, Hassan Rouhani promised that all religions, even religious minorities, must feel justice. That promise remains unfulfilled. The U.S. calls on Iran to keep that promise and to stop depriving its people of the fundamental right to religious freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.